I apologize that there's not going to be any physics in this talk. I'm trying to learn physics, but it'll take quite a long time before I can actually give a talk that has physics in it, unless you're like V.I. Arnold and believe that mathematics is physics where the experiments are cheap. This is actually more or less a continuation of what I said at the colloquium, in the sense that we're going to talk about moduli spaces of principal bundles, except the groups that we're considering principal bundles for are somewhat more complicated than last time to some extent, in the sense that the groups themselves are varying. They're also shapes. So I'll say what I mean as we go along. But I don't assume that anybody here normally thinks about number theory, right? So I'll start out, right, with a very brief review of the background on arithmetic of algebraic curves. Can everybody see okay? Okay. Right, so this is more or less, I'm going to describe a problem that's, for whatever reason, been motivating me for many years now. It has to do with something very elementary. So you start with a smooth algebraic curve of a given genus defined over Q. So concretely, you can just think of it as being given by a polynomial equation in two variables, with rational coefficients. And the genus, this is a geometric invariant. This is, of course, the genus of the Riemann surface you get if you look at complex solutions. But most of the time, you can just take it to be just given by that formula, d minus 1, d minus 1 over 2. And it turns out that that's an important thing to pay attention to. Although it's a topological invariant, it influences the arithmetic quite a bit. So the Diophantine geometry, of course, is concerned with the set of rational solutions to this equation. Right? And a basic fact that's been known for a very long time is that the structure is quite different in these three cases when genus is 0, genus is 1, and genus is greater than or equal to 2. Somehow you divide up into these three cases, which has certain corresponding geometric properties associated with it as well. But somehow the geometry and the arithmetic seem to influence each other in subtle ways. Okay. So let me give you a brief overview of what's known in these three situations. Right? So as I said, this is just pure number theory. So the somewhat embarrassing fact for number theory is that you now, after millennia, literally millennia of studying these problems, right? The only case that's completely well understood is when the genus is 0. Yeah? In all other cases, there are many open problems and the structure is still quite mysterious. Now, what happens in the genus zero case is that ways for discussing the solution, the structure of the rational solutions, is actually reduced to this thing that people call class field theory and algebraic geometry. Yeah. So, of course, I'm not going to survey this in any detail today. But the general idea in the genus zero case, but actually even in the higher genus, depending on how you use these ideas, is that you study rational solutions by considering the geometry of solutions in various completions of the rational, like the reals, the two-adic, three-adic, and so on, the various p-adic completions and the rational completions. So these are fields that have much more of a geometric flavor, right? And it becomes easier to study solutions in those fields. And it's possible to start to get information about rational solutions by looking at it in these larger fields. So for example, so here's a typical theorem. So you look at an equation like this, right? So it's not so obvious whether that has any solutions or not, right? But in fact, this has a rational solution if and only if it has a solution in those five fields, right? If it has a real solution, obviously it has a real solution, right? But also two-adic solutions, 37-adic solution, 59-adic solution, and 67-adic solution. It has to do with those coefficients, of course, right? It will be exactly have a solution if it has a solution in those fields. So this is sometimes called the Hasse principle. And the point is that checking for solutions, I'm not going to tell you how to do it now. This is where a bit of local class field theory comes in. But checking for solutions in these fields can be effectively decided. So there's an algorithm that allows you to do this. So this local global method is the main thing that makes the genus zero case solvable. So in other words, another way of saying it is that you can put the rational solution inside the product of all p-adic solutions, right? And somehow the structure of this set influences very tightly the structure of the rational solution set. And the study of the relation between these two sets, you know, the study of these inclusion is sometimes called the study of reciprocity laws in number theory. Right, now let's look at the genus one case. So here already things are much more mysterious. And one of the reasons that it's more mysterious is, well, okay, first of all, the whole range of possibility occurs. There might be no solutions, non-empty finite set of solutions, or infinite, all are possible. And the main, one of the main reasons, anyways, for the difficulty is that the Hasse principle, the local global principle I mentioned earlier, actually fails. So this is an example of an equation that has a solution in the reals and in the p-adics for all p, but it has no rational solutions. So this is one of the early examples of an equation of this nature. So some local to global principle fails in this case, and that contributes to the complexity of this situation. Many of you may know that if there is a rational solution, then we can fix any rational solution as an origin, yeah, and give the rational solution the structure of a finitely generated abelian group. That happens only for cubic curves. Yeah. For a cubic curve, the fact that a line tends to hit three points on the plane curve allows us to define a group law. Yeah. And then using that group law, one can show that, in fact, the infinitude, even when it's infinite, can be relatively controlled. You know, it's a finitely generated abelian group. So it has this nature. There's some finite group part, the torsion part for the group law, and then a free part. Right? And that R here is sometimes called the rank of the curve. Now this part, the torsion part, can be really effectively computed very easily, in fact. Yeah? Just to give you a flavor of it, so here's a theorem. If you want to compute the torsion part, it turns out that the curves of that sort in the genus 1 case always have a model of this form, right? So that actually you can ignore this infinity if you want, but to get a group law, you need to regard a point at infinity as the origin in this form. Well, if you write the curve in this form, right, the equation in this form, then if x comma y is a torsion point, then they are necessarily integral. They can't have any denominator, and y squared has to divide this quantity. That's sometimes called the discriminant of this equation. So you can imagine, given the equation, you can easily compute this quantity and try out all possibilities for y squared. Yeah, and see if you get the solutions or not. So in this form, you can compute the torsion part very easily, but the computation of the rank and a full set of generators, of course, what would it mean to completely describe the rational solution set? Since it's a finitely generated abelian group, you want to describe a set of generators. If you understand those, the rest are all obtained from there by this chord and tangent group law. But this is very difficult, and it's unknown, in fact, how to do it. And this is the subject of the conjecture of Birch and Swinton-Dyer, which is one of the major open problems in number theory. So this is, of course, you may know that this is an unsolved problem and a very difficult problem. But curiously, in practice, you can often compute. In practice, for example, if you take a curve like this, right? And then and put it into a computer program, then it'll immediately tell you that, in fact, the rank is 1. It'll take half a second. And it will tell you that the obvious solution, 3, 5, in fact, generates the whole thing. All solutions are multiples of this one according to the group law. So if you're at all interested in these problems and you've never done this before, it's good to play with computers. So for example, you get answers like this out of Sage somehow. You can also compute multiples of this point according to the group law. And you can see that they get large very, very quickly. Yeah? The numerators and denominators get very large. This is twice of that point according to the group law, thrice of that point, and so on. Okay? Minus of that point is 3 comma minus 5. Also, you can draw pictures like this, which you should do. So this is, if you keep taking multiples of the point, and I've plotted the denominators, it looks like this. You know, this parabola is part of the pattern that you get when you compute multiples of a number, of a solution. Okay, anyways. So that's a flavor of what happens in genus 1. Now, what happens in genus at least 2, that's the so-called higher genus case corresponding to hyperbolic geometry. What happens is that the set of rational solutions is always finite. So that's good, right? So it should be very simple. This was the so-called Mordell conjecture that was proved by Faltings in the 1980s, right? But from a different point of view, so mathematicians know that finite sets are very hard, right? So this is an example of that. In fact, that is to say, the set of solutions is finite, but in fact, it seems to be very difficult to compute that set of solutions. So for example, you may consider this particular case, right? So it's a very simple, well-defined equation, and it took many, many years for people to be able to list the complete set of solutions to this equation, right? Sometimes it's very easy, like this one, right? So obviously, you can see that there's no solution in this case, right? Simply because there's no real solutions. But sometimes it's very hard, like the one above. And so one kind of general principle is that when there isn't some kind of an obvious reason for non-existence of solutions, for example, if there already is one solution, like the one above, right, then it's very hard to know when it is you have the full list of solutions. That's the difficulty regarding this situation. Yeah? And this problem seems to be much harder than the Bertrand-Sonnet-Dyer conjecture, roughly speaking. So listing the complete set of solutions in the higher genus case. So for example, if you take an equation like this, right? This equation obviously has the solution 0,1729, right? Obviously. But if I ask you whether there are any other solutions or not, it's very hard to tell. In fact, I don't know the answer. It's obvious because I generated the equation by cubing this number. Okay, but as I said, even in that case, you can easily generate a solution by fixing the equation in this way, but it's very hard to know if there are any others, right? So the problem surrounding this is sometimes called the effective Mordell problem. Yeah? The proof of finiteness, right, was called the Mordell conjecture, right? And now I'm calling this the effective Mordell problem, which is to find a terminating algorithm that when somebody hands you an equation of genus at least two, will output this finite set. And this is an unsolved problem, seemingly much more difficult than the BSD conjecture. Sometimes people state these things in terms of the effective Mordell conjecture. In other words, sometimes there are people who tell you that the rational solutions have to satisfy certain Heide inequalities, that the denominators and numerators have to be at most this size, where the size is determined by the equation. So there are conjectures of this nature, which are equally difficult sounding, but I'm phrasing the problem slightly differently. Rather than actually giving a priori bound for the size of solution, I'm saying, well, let's just try to find the terminating algorithm, and that's also an unsolved problem. Right. So what I'm going to do now is describe an approach to this problem using the arithmetic geometry of principal bundles, a kind of arithmetic gauge theory. Yeah. Maybe I'll make a little bit brief historical remark before I get into the actual principal bundle story that I'm interested in today. That is to say, this whole range of problem actually was originally studied using principal bundles from a modern point of view right now. Right? By whom? Well, mostly by many people, but especially André Weil. I'm just setting up the notation again. If you take a smooth projective curve of genus at least two defined over Q, what André Weil did in 1929, he constructed an embedding of the curve into this thing called its Jacobian. Yeah? So there are many constructions of the Jacobian. Right? For example, it could be the moduli space or line bundles of degree zero. And this embedding, of course, is just, I should have said that the, I'm getting a little bit tangled up. Let me restate. This Jacobian, as a complex torus, was constructed in the 19th century, and people studied this already when they were studying abelian integrals, right? So you can define it as a complex torus in this form using modern language, and then that map is defined by an integral. Now, but the point of Weil's construction was that, this was already known, but was that when X is a curve defined over Q, you get an algebraic variety that's also defined over Q, not a complex torus, right? So that was the point. And in fact, the key point is that this map is also defined over Q. so that you can use this construction to put the rational solutions of the curve into the rational solutions of the Jacobian. So that was the strategy. Now, having done that, what they proved was that, in fact, this is an abelian group, again, similar to the case of an elliptic curve, even though this is nothing like an abelian group. Right? And he proved that this is also finitely generated in general. It's higher dimensional. It has dimension g, where g is the genus of the curve. And this higher dimensional abelian variety still has a finitely generated abelian group of rational points. And the proof is actually more or less identical to what you do with elliptic curve once you have the language of algebraic geometry. So he thought, well, one should be able to use this fact to get back at the points of the curve. And he failed. He couldn't do it. So this was in his thesis, PhD thesis. And he wanted to prove the model conjecture using this finite generation of these points somehow, but he failed.
At some point, you qualified it as to be a smooth algebraic curve or something.
That's right, yeah.
Is that a strong, what is that condition?
Oh, it's just some non-vanishing of some Jacobian matrices for the defining equation. So it's a generic, most curves are smooth.
Most of them.
Yeah, they don't have to worry about that condition. Okay, so that was something that they tried out in his thesis. Then about 10 years later, well, 1938, he also studied the moduli space of principle of GLN bundles under curve. Yeah? So I think people working on some aspects of physics know this space reasonably well, right? And so this was first studied by Wey as well in 1938. There was a paper called A Generalization of Theta Functions, something like this. Right? But what's very, so of course, this space has been very influential and studied a lot. But what's maybe not so well known is that Wey constructed this to prove the model conjecture. That's what he says more or less in the introduction to the paper. He was interested in the model conjecture because, you see, he realized that the Jacobian, because it's abelian, it has this abelian group structure that allows you to keep generating points out of old point, more points out of old point, new points out of old point. So he said, somehow, in order to get a non-abelian structure like the rational points of the curve, you should have some kind of a non-abelian Jacobian. So he thought it would be a good idea to study this. Of course, he failed here as well. It didn't work. But of course, this space was very influential in algebraic geometry. So, you know, there's theorems like this, the theorem of Narashman and Seshadri, theorems by, there was extensions by Donaldson, which influenced his work on gauge theory and non-abelian Hodge theory and so on. There were many developments that arose out of this construction of moduli spaces of bundles on a curve, right? But it's interesting that the original motivation actually was the model conjecture. Now, Serre mentions this, right, in his Serre mentions this fact in his obituary for Wey a number of years ago. And then he says, well, Wey was ahead of his time because they didn't have a proper algebraic geometric construction of this moduli space, and that's what the problem was. Now, it may be true that Wey was ahead of his time, but this assessment that the construction of the moduli space as an algebraic geometric object was the problematic thing is completely wrong, because now we do know how to construct this in as geometric way as we want, but nobody succeeded in using this bungee space in order to prove the model conjecture. That's not the way it works. It's an interesting challenge, in fact. Can you use this space as a non-abelian Jacobian to prove the model conjecture? I have some ideas if you're interested in a difficult problem. Yeah. Right. And eventually, the model conjecture was proved by Faltin using the geometry of the moduli stack of principally polarized abelian variety. Essentially, he deduces the model conjecture from the finiteness of integral points on this stack of principally polarized abelian varieties. Right. Okay, so that's the history part. So now I'm going to go on to discuss the arithmetic principle bundles that forms the basis of a strategy that I've been thinking about for quite a few years. So part of this story is very well known, right? And especially to people who work on elliptic curves. So let me review some basic notions. So first of all, what do I mean by an arithmetic principle bundle? So I'm going to take a very hands-on approach rather than discussing shapes. So I'll just describe it in terms of triples, a group, I'll write a G sub K, another group R in the principal bundle P. So what are these things? So I'll take field K here to be a field of characteristic zero. G sub K is the absolute Galois group of K, right? That's the automorphism group fixing K of the algebraic closure of an algebraic closure. When I refer to a group over K, what I mean is a topological group R together with a continuous action of GK by group automorphisms. Yeah? So this corresponds to the fact that there's somehow a sheaf over K, over the spectrum of K. Then a principal R bundle over K is a topological space with a compatible action of G and R, right? G acting on the left and R acting on the right. So compatibility means the obvious thing. If you act first and act with the Galois group, then that's the same as acting with the Galois group and acting on the right. So that's the notions, I hope, are simple enough, right? So that's what we mean by a group over K and a principal bundle over K. Of course, there's a category of such things that I'm not going to to dwell too much on today, but I will note that the principal bundle is trivial exactly when there's a fixed point for the Galois action. So that's exactly when it would be trivial. I will make that observation because that sort of is a property that has some content that can help us to understand these notions. Right, so here's a kind of simple example. So, for example, you can take inside the algebraic closure the group of p power roots of unity. So here you'll have a group that's isomorphic to the cyclic group on p to the n elements, right? And you take inverse limits of such things under p power max. So this is a very one of the first examples of these groups defined over K, because obviously this is isomorphic. So if you want to describe this precisely, these are compatible system of p power roots of unity. Right? That's what it means to take the inverse limit. So as a group, this is isomorphic to the p-adic integers, but of course, because the Galois group permutes these roots of unity, it has a continuous action of the Galois group. So you get a group, a non-trivial group defined over K. If you want an example of a principal bundle, what you can do is you can fix some x inside K star, anything other than one, and take p power roots of it. Then it will have two actions, right? Exactly. On the one end, it will be permuted by roots of unity, right? But also there will be action of the Galois group, which takes one p power root of x to the other, right? So maybe here already you can get some intuitive sense that there's some feeling whereby the action of the roots of unity feels a little bit like internal symmetries, whereas the Galois action feels like external. Now, as I said earlier, this principal bundle is trivial exactly if X admits a p power root of unity in K for all n, right? That's when there's a Galois fixed point inside this set of compatible systems. And so, for example, when K is a field like C, this principal bundle will always be trivial because, of course, any number has all the p power roots of unity you want. When K is something like Q, then in fact, this is never trivial unless X is 1. This will never be trivial. If X is 1, this is trivial because 1 can be taken as a p power root of itself repeatedly, right? And so there is an element fixed under the Galois. And if K is R and P is odd, then Px is trivial for all X, right? And if K is even, Px is trivial if and only if X is positive, right? So you can see how properties of this principal bundle in some sense encodes some arithmetic properties. So this simple example always hopefully already gives you some indication of this. So I'll denote by H1 of K with coefficients in R, the isomorphism class of principal R bundles over K. Now you can give an explicit description of this using continuous non-abelian group homology of this Galois group, right? But I'm not going to bother with that so much because that's not such a useful description. But I will note that the main case we're interested in is when K is a number field, like Q, right? Then there are all these completions, like p-adics and reals and so on. And the Galois groups, absolute Galois groups of the completions will map to the absolute Galois group of the number field. So you can take a group over K and restrict it to a group over KV, and same for principal bundles, right? By just restricting the action. So in fact, you get this thing called the localization map, that takes a principal bundle over K and associates to it a collection of principal bundle over the completions for all B. So it's not an exaggeration to say that, in fact, a wide range of problems in number theory is really about the study of the image of this localization. Can you describe the image? And if you can, in these various situations, maybe 80% of the important problems in number theory will go away. So, of course, what is the question? When you have a collection of local principal bundle, when does it come from a global principal bundle? That's the problem. Mm-hmm.
You call it a bundle. Does it have a base space associated?
Yeah, it's spectrum of K. That's right. Yeah. But I'm sort of suppressing that viewpoint and just saying that the Galois action is encoding the fact that there's a base space. Right. Okay. So that's a generalities and principle. Let me give you an example of how you use this for number theory. You're starting using the case of elliptic curves. Okay. So take an elliptic curve over Q. Right? We just said that it has this group structure, right? So what we can do is we can take the Q bar solution. So there are plenty of those, right? But not necessarily rational. And consider the P multiplication map. So it turns out that this is surjective on Q bar points. There's no point problem in finding points that map to any given point over Q bar. And the kernel will be the P torsion inside Q bar. So you get an exact sequence like this. So if you consider the invariance under the Galois group, you get an exact sequence that goes from the rational p-torsion goes to the rational point, goes to the rational point, but this is now no longer surjective, and you get a connecting homomorphism to an H1 in group cohomology. And so then, if we just look at this connecting homomorphism part, you get an inclusion from the points mod p, right, to this H1. Now remember, and we're viewing this as a kind of space of principal bundle for this group over Q. Now, what's the point? Is that the central problem, in some sense, in the theory of elliptic curve, is trying to identify this image. So I'll elaborate this slightly better in the next slide. But the point is that this H1, in many senses, can be explicitly described. But we don't know what this subgroup is, although we know that this group sits inside the H1 somehow. But we don't know what it is. So if you can compute this quotient EQ modulo PEQ, then that more or less gives you the way to compute all of Q. So I'll leave that step out as well. Yeah, for example, you can see that the rank can be easily read off from this quotient group. Right? So you can even compute the complete set of generators once you can describe this explicitly. So in fact, describing this group explicitly is a key problem. And that is a subgroup of this H1 by the previous exact sequence, but identifying that subgroup is really the central problem. Okay. Now, to this end, so what you can do is you define something called the P-Selmer group, right, to describe this image slightly better. So what are these? These are the classes in here that locally come from points. What do I mean by that? Well, we're interested in which classes here come from actual points, right? So just let's compute the ones that locally come from points. That is to say, there's what's this localization map for each V, right? Now inside here, you can look at the image of the corresponding V-adic version of that map, right? And the key point is that this map can be computed. Local problems are easy. I indicated that earlier, right? In fact, the image of this can be identified. So in fact, if you've done that, or if you believe that you can do that, then what you can do is you can look at those guys here that locally are inside the image for every V. That's what the Selmer group is, the P-Selmer group. Right? So then you know, of course, that this Mordell-Weil group, this is called the Mordell-Weil group, mod P, has to be contained inside the Selmer group. Yeah? So that's how you narrow down the image in some way. And in fact, this P-Selmer group is a finite dimensional FP vector space. And as I said, this is what can be really explicitly written down given the elliptic curve. So that these are the locally trivial principal bundle for EP. And this can be completely described as an FP vector space. So this, you can see, is already good, because this will give you an upper bound on the dimension of this space and also already allow you to control the rank, yeah, if you want an upper bound on the rank. But you might still want to know, but you still want to know it precisely. In order to do that, you refine it using a diagram like this. You use powers of P instead of just P. So you get diagrams like this. but you see, if you have a class here that comes from here, then of course, this map is obviously surjective, right? So a class that lies inside the image of the model vague group has to lift up here for every n. So that's the strategy. You compute this for every n, and you compute this map. Right? And the classes here that come from points have to be liftable for every n. So, and in fact, the conjecture, or a major part of the conjecture of Chansvindasthadaya, is that the image of the model vague group is exactly equal to those classes are, that are liftable to the p to the n Samar group for every n. So that's the conjecture.
Bounds on n?
No. at least that's a tricky issue. That's a very good question, but it's a tricky issue. But of course, since this is a finite dimensional vector space, in principle, this has to occur. If this is true, it has to occur at a finite n, right? So you can keep computing. And so I'm going to be sketchy on about this portion. But what you can do is you can keep computing for n. And the conjecture says eventually the image of the model vague group has to equal the classes that are liftable mod p to the n. And there's a conditional algorithm for verifying this. You keep computing points by ordered by heights as much as you want. you compute day by day, as people say, you compute points by day and compute the image liftable classes by night. Yeah? And eventually they have to coincide. That's what the conjecture says, right? And there's a way that you can, when they coincide, you can check this, right? So what I've described here is a conditional algorithm for completely identifying the image of this guy inside the Samar group, the P Samar group. Right? The point is that this algorithm terminates only if this conjecture is true. Yeah? This algorithm is what's used by the programs right now. Yeah? It's conditional. Its termination is conditional on BSD, but in practice, it's always terminated. And that's how people compute ranks and model vague group and so on. So in other words, if we take a physics viewpoint, obviously this is a completely well-established theory, right? We have reams and reams of data at this point, hundreds of millions of elliptic curves where this algorithm terminates, right? So if you view the conjecture as a theory, it's been experimentally verified all you want. Anyway, so this is a flavor of how you use principal bundles and so let me restate. This space, the space of principal bundle, is something that can be computed. And you'd like to use this to compute points. Okay, now what happens for higher genus curves? This is the non-abelian case, so to speak. In order to do that, to generalize this discussion, let me focus briefly on the sequence of maps that we've just considered, right? That there's the P torsion, there's the P square torsion, P cube torsion, all related by this P power map, right? So you can take the inverse limit of these things, and this is sometimes called the p-adic Tate module of the elliptic curve. Now, each one of these is isomorphic to z mod p to the n cross z mod p to the n, so that when you take this inverse limit, you get a free zp module, the integral p-adic integers, right, modules. A module for the periodic integers of rank 2, where it has this non-trivial Galois action. And the previous finite boundary maps can be packaged into a boundary map that goes all at once from the rational points to this inverse limit of these things. but the point is that this periodic Tate module is actually a fundamental group. This is canonically isomorphic to the fundamental group of the elliptic curve with base point at the origin. So here, when I write pi1 pxb, that refers to the pro-p fundamental group of a variety x with base point at p. So what is pro-p? Sorry, I guess I should have explained this, sorry. You take a group, right, and you consider all quotients that are p power order. And consider inverse limit of those. So compatible sequences of elements inside p power order quotients of the fundamental group. Okay. And if you do that, you get that's isomorphic to the Tate module. And this previous map, J, remember, is supposed to associate to a point, a principal bundle for this fundamental group, right? What is that principal bundle? It's actually just the principal bundle given by the homotopy classes of paths from zero, from the origin to X. That is what the map is. So that's an interpretation of the previous discussion purely in terms of homotopy groups and fundamental and homotopy classes of paths. And why does one do this? Well, because if you do this, well, it's easy to generalize this to other varieties. Yeah? So remember, I said the arithmetic principal bundle consisted of this absolute Galois group over a field of characteristic zero, right? A group with action by the Galois group, and a principal bundle with a compatible action. Well, so the fundamental fact, right, that I call the fundamental fact of arithmetic homotopy, in fact, is that if you take a variety defined over Q and two rational points, right, then in fact, the fundamental group and the homotopy classes of paths actually have an action of the Galois group. So if you'd like, if you want to use slightly fanciful language, which is kind of suggestive sometimes, is that these homotopy invariants of a variety, if the variety is defined over Q, actually have this hidden arithmetic symmetry coming from the Galois group, reflecting the fact that your situation is defined over Q.
Is the Procopy completion of the Galois group or fundamental group the same as what I'd get if I just worked over C?
Yeah, that is what this is. That's what it is. It has the Etal interpretation, but you just take the topological fundamental group and take its Procopy completion. Then it picks up this Galois action. So that's the kind of miracle of this theory. Once you take any reasonable completion, in fact, once you take any non-Archimedean completion of these homotopy invariants, then it picks up an action of the Galois group. Yeah. So this triple is kind of course, the main example of this principal arithmetic principal bundles I defined at the beginning. Right. So as I'll give a very brief sketch of where this Galois action comes from. So that's because you see, you can construct a pro-P universal covering. Right? So there's a usual universal covering, which is a big topological covering, right? But you can just consider covering spaces that are themselves of P power degree. And this whole system can be viewed as a pro-P universal covering of the variety. And the basic fact is that if you choose a lift of the base point from X to this pro-P universal covering, in other words, a compatible system of base point lifts to all the elements of this covering, then in fact, the pro-P completion of the fundamental group is just the fiber over the base point, and the homotopy classes of paths becomes isomorphic to the fiber over a given point X of this pro-P covering. So that's the kind of canonical isomorphism that comes from path lifts, right, to a universal covering.
Can you explain the notation? What is the first thing, pi 1 of x, is the base point in B?
Right.
The second one is pi 1 of x.
The homotopy classes of paths from B to x.
Oh.
Yeah, sorry, I should have said that. I said that too quickly, I think. But then that becomes just the same as the fiber of the universal covering over x by lifting paths to. By homotopy lifting property. But the key point is that if X is an algebraic variety, first of all, each Xi is canonically algebraic. This is the Riemann existence theorem in algebraic geometry, right? And furthermore, if X is defined over Q, right, then this whole system becomes defined over Q. That's because of the universal property that allows you to descend the whole thing to wherever X is defined over. And now, so if this is just a system of varieties defined over Q, it's not surprising that the fibers over rational points admit Galois actions. That's how you think about the existence of these Galois actions. This is a rather concrete way of thinking about it. But to actually compute it, of course, what do you need to do? You need to somehow be able to compute this pro-P universal covering, which is quite hard in general. Okay. So now let's go back to Diophantine geometry. As I already hinted, of course, now we see how to generalize that elliptic curves theory, right? That you can start with a variety with a fixed rational base point, and then consider a map from rational points to principal bundles for the pro-P fundamental group that sends a point to the homotopy classes of paths. So there's a straightforward generalization of the elliptic curve picture. Except this is no longer a group, right? This is just a pointed set. most possibly complicated structure, which is a pointed topological space. Now, for every prime V, there are also local versions of this. Again, you just restrict the Galois action to the absolute Galois group of the local fields. And so these local versions are far more computable than the global thing, so that in fact it makes sense to consider this diagram. Yeah? That from rational points, you can associate this global principal bundles, right, with the global Galois action, or you can put rational points inside the products of eidetic points, to which you can associate collections of local principal bundles. So you get a compatible diagram like this, right? So I said earlier on when we started discussing genus 1 curves, this local to global principle fails except for genus 0 curve, but you still use it somehow in a more sophisticated form. You know? It's not exactly that if this is non-empty, this is non-empty, and you don't get simple things like that, but you can still try to use this inclusion by translating it into an inclusion of principal bundles. Right? So as in the elliptic curve case, in fact, you can see that our main interest will therefore be the interaction between the image of this localization and the image of the local point inside this local moduli spaces of principal bundles. Now, I'm going to put one other black box on you, which is that for actual application, you need to use not quite the pro-P completion, but something called the QP pro-unipotent completion of the fundamental group. So this is the group that classified locally constant sheaves of QP vector spaces over X. I don't know if I... example. Yeah, sorry, I should have given some examples of this. So this is actually a fairly straightforward construction. You see, when you're considering fundamental groups of topological spaces, there are various algebraic group versions of that, and this is one of them. Now you can turn the study of fundamental groups into algebraic group completions, and this is one such thing. So, for example, if pi 1 is z, this is literally just tensoring with QP, right? But if pi 1 is something like integral matrices, upper triangular matrices, then you just replace that by upper triangular matrices with QP entries. That's what this tensoring with QP, unipotent completion, the flavor of this construction. Right.
Is the point that are the QP points of some algebraic group?
That's right. Yeah. So that's exactly. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah, I should have said that more clearly. This is a pro-algebraic group over QP. That's right. And you can do this to any group, in fact, right? In particular to the fundamental group of a variety. But even if you go to this QP completion, the Galois action still survives. So we can set up the same diagram, right, with this unipotent completion instead of the pro-P completion. But what's the advantage of this is that once you use this unipotent completion, these things here are algebraic varieties. The previous ones were just topological spaces with a very complicated topology. But now these are pro-algebraic varieties. So now there's there are a few local conditions that I'm going to ignore that similar to these conditions, the Selmer group conditions that arose from elliptic curve. But eventually, you set up this diagram. Okay, sorry, let me go back. It might be better to illustrate in this picture. So you see, what's the nice thing about studying these moduli spaces? Now these are algebraic varieties, and this localization map is now an algebraic map. Inclusion of the rational points inside the local points is a very strange inclusion, right? But this is just a map of algebraic varieties. So in principle, this is something that you can compute. So that's the general idea.
Is there anything to be gained by, instead of thinking about principal bundles for the fundamental group, you take like UP vector bundles?
You can do that as well, sure, yeah. So for example, you can certainly choose a representation of U and turn it into something about
this is some kind of limit as those representations get big or something.
That's right. So this is a limit you can over all unipotent representations of the fundamental group. That's right. And in fact, some work of Venkatesh and Lawrence recently was exactly using a vector bundle version of this rather than the principal bundle. I prefer to use principal bundles myself, but some people like vector bundles. Right. Okay, so anyways, let me repeat. So this is now an algebraic map that can be computed and allows us to control takes the inclusion of global points inside the cube. So to say that more precisely, so suppose that in fact, so this is some algebraic variety. So suppose you had an algebraic function on this space that vanishes on the image of the localization map, right? Then you can pull that back to the local points, and you get a function on this space that annihilates the global points. So that's how you can try to locate the rational points. So to make this concretely computable, you can take the projection to some fixed p-adic points, right? Because now this infinite product is hard to imagine, even though I said I spoke casually about it. So you project to one p. So what you can do is then consider the zero set coming from algebraic functions in the previous picture, consider the projections to p, and take the intersection over all algebraic functions that cut out the image of the localization map. So that's a subset now of the p-adic points. And we can try to compute this. So now let me state this non-abelian effective model conjecture, yeah? Which is that if we take the intersection, so x now is a curve of genus at least 2, right? Sorry, I forgot to say that. And if you take the intersection over zero sets obtained from all algebraic functions alpha, that should exactly cut out the rational points. Yeah? And secondly, this set should be effectively computable. So these are non-abelian generalization of many complicated aspects of this BST picture.
Do you really need genus 2, or do you need hyperbolic?
Yeah, that's right, hyperbolic, that's right. Okay. But I'm willing to make this conjecture only for smooth projective curves, so it's the same. Although examples often include the affine case. Yeah. Okay, so maybe I'll skip. There's a certain reciprocity law associated
maybe
to this.
Maybe a quick question. So like your your fundamental group and stuff, these are groups of integer points, and then you're replacing it with p-adic points, or is it?
Sorry?
So your original group was a group of integral points or something, and then you enlarged it to p-adic? Fundamental groups?
Fundamental group is just a discrete group, right? And you turn that into a p-adic algebraic group, that's right. Okay, let me show you examples of how this works. So for example, so in fact, this is the affine example you mentioned. So the simplest case is if x is p1 minus 3 points. And Deligne wrote a long paper on this in the 1980s, which sort of got this story started, right? And so in that case, the first non-trivial case is to consider the so-called two integral points of this curve. So the points of this curve that have denominators only at 2, yeah? At powers of 2. So if you compute that, you get exactly 2 minus 1, 1/2. They're just exactly 3 points. Right? It turns out to belong to the zero set of two analytic functions that have this form. So this D2 is sometimes called a Rogers dilogarithm, right? Where LK is this K logarithm that appears in the theory of complex, well, it appears in many places. And D4 is computed out of the K logarithm according to this slightly complicated formula, right? And so I guess I didn't say, maybe I should have explained this slightly more. So sorry about that, let me go back briefly. So it said that you take a function here, right, that vanishes on the image of map and pull it back here, right? When you do that, what you get is a p-adic analytic function. The description of this map is in terms of p-adic iterated integral. That's why you get those formulas of the sort that I described earlier. So if you carry out that procedure for this curve, what you get is that the integral points, two integral points, lie inside the zero set of these two functions. Right? And numerically, so those guys have checked this inclusion for not that many primes. I don't know why it's so hard to compute that, but I don't know anything about actual computation. I just have friends who do it. So they've checked this for, anyways, all primes less than 1,000, and then you get an exact equality numerically in those cases. So there are some qualitative results that you can prove using this, not effective ones, but qualitative results. So for example, using this machinery, it's easy to give a new proof that these kind of Fermat, generalized Fermat equations have finitely many rational points.
Can you say how you got those functions? You said the other guy in the previous slide.
Right, yeah, I should have written that down more carefully. So the point is that if you look at this, is this the best that this, I can't seem to, okay, to get any. So there was this map, right? So the local classifying space for unipotent, for principal bundles for U, right? Well, if you compute this map, this involves iterated integrals. So this can be described in terms of a symmetric space. Uses the so-called Drum fundamental group. So this is what I said earlier, the local maps can be explicitly described. And when you've done this, you get iterated integrals of differential forms on the curve.
Like
that's right, exactly. It's a generalization of the complex analytic description of the Abel-Jacobi map from the 19th century in a p-adic setting. So instead of abelian integrals, you get iterated integrals. So algebraic functions on this pull back to these analytic functions. So polynomials here become polynomials of iterated integrals when you pull it back to the p-adic form. So that's where those functions come. So there are qualitative results like this. It would be, so for a while, when we first proved this, I thought, well, if we really work hard, we should be able to reprove Fermat's Laplace theorem, but it seems to be too hard at the moment to make it that precise. You may wonder whether there are these algebraic functions alpha exist, right? So there are standard structural conjectures about mixed motives that generalized BSD that tell you that plenty of such alpha should exist. I didn't say this earlier, but there's a certain descending central series filtration that allows you to go up the levels. As n increases, you should get more and more of these alphas. That's what these structural conjectures tell you. So in fact, you should always get plenty of functions to annihilate global points. Recently, Lawrence and Venkatesh used a variation of this idea to give an unconditional new proof of faulting theorem, yeah, over number fields, except you have to replace U by a reductive completion of pi 1. So U is a unipotent completion. You have to take a reductive completion with respect to some fixed semi-simple representation. That's the vector bundle you mentioned. So then things become somehow. So it's still hard work, but they managed to at least show that there are only finitely many rational points using this circle of ideas. A fairly nice recent result by these five authors, right, deals with the split, so-called split modular curve of level 13. Right? I mentioned this because this curve was quite mysterious for a long time. So how do you, what is this? So you first take Xn, which is the compactification of moduli space of pairs, elliptic curve with a so-called full level n structure, yeah, choice of basis for the n torsion points. Right? And then inside GL2 of Z mod n, you can take the normalizer of a split Cartan subgroup and mod out further by that. So that's what this split modular curve of level n means. Yeah? It's the quotient of the full level structure by that split Cartan subgroup, normalizer of a split Cartan subgroup. So what had happened was that when n is a prime, Bilou, Para, and Horebo-Yedo had shown that the rational points on this curve consist entirely of cusps and CM points for all primes bigger than 7, as long as p is not equal to 13. and they couldn't figure out t equals 13, all existing techniques fail, so they call p equals 13 the cursed level. Yeah. And so these authors showed that, in fact, for this modular curve as well, this has exactly 7 rational points consisting of the cusp and 6 CM points using the functions obtained by this diagram. Yeah. So So that curve, I can't explain it now, but it has to do with an effective version of something called Sayre's open image theorem that motivated people to want to figure out completely the set of rational points on those modular curves. So the problem itself goes back to the 1970s, and it was finished off by those authors.
What about the smaller primes? Was that already known? Or?
Yeah, it fails for those smaller primes. Yeah. So that's what they prove. So here's a picture. And that's the equation for the curve. You should write it out explicitly, right? And these are the 7 points. And what they showed is that they produced enough of those functions alpha to show that there are no other points. I mentioned earlier that, so these 7 points were known since long ago. It was hard to prove that there were no more. That's what these authors said. Okay, so what happened now? Right. Sorry about that. It seems to disappear for some reason. Okay, so that's just to give you a flavor of the way one uses this machinery to compute sets of rational points. So now let me close with speculation. So you see, I guess I didn't use this notation today. This is notation from last week's lecture. In some sense, you'd like to think about these global principles bundles sitting inside collections of local principle bundles as being something like global gauge fields, solutions to equations of motion sitting inside arbitrary gauge fields. But you can make this substantially more precise. How so? Well, you see, when x is smooth and projective, rational points are the same as integral points. And what you're actually interested in is not just the image of the localization map, but there's also local integrality condition defined by something called Pierre-Descouches theory that the classes coming from integer points have to satisfy. So it's actually an intersection you're interested in, not just the image of the localization map. So now, this is almost like a Lagrangian intersection. It doesn't quite work. In order to make it apply symplectic techniques, you have to replace U by a kind of twisted cotangent bundle. But when you do that, in fact, this product over primes, so any set of primes, right, of this local moduli space becomes a symplectic algebraic variety over QP. And the image of the localization map, as well as the product of these local integral conditions, are in fact Lagrangian subvarieties. So it's the intersection we're interested in. And so, Kevin knows this much better, and I barely know the meaning of these words that I'm trying hard to learn, is that when you take the derived intersection of this image, right, that has a minus one shifted symplectic structure, so essentially, it's the critical set of a function. So that's the theorem of these people and maybe other people. I'm not very well up on the literature regarding this. So essentially, this problem of identifying the principal bundles of interest is actually, in principle, finding the critical set of a function. So to return to this diagram, we're interested in the integral point sitting inside here, but in fact, it lies inside the inverse image under this principal bundle map on local points of the critical set of a function. Right? Of course, this by itself isn't particularly useful information, right? But what one can dream is that maybe one can somehow construct this function explicitly using the geometry of the situation. I don't know how to do it, but anyways, that's the speculation surrounding this circle of idea. So why do I like this idea, right? This is really the kind of a historical fairy tale, namely. So if you look at, this is Fermat. Now, I think Fermat was a really great scientist in the 17th century. His full range of achievements doesn't seem to be as well known as you expect them to be. But anyways, but in number theory, of course, he was the first person to sort of set out the modern theory of Diophantine equations. So it's the history says that he was interested in these number theory problems, and he tried to interest his colleagues, right? People that he wrote to, eminent scientists all around Europe who were his correspondents. And when he tried to interest them in number theory problems, nobody was interested, right? Because you can imagine, these seem like trivial problems compared to serious problems like this, right? So it took a while for these number theoretic ideas to catch on. But what I like about this previous diagram is that somehow these two problems are the same, right? The solving the critical point problem, yeah, seems to be leading to solving the global solution, integral solutions to Diophantine equation problem. So one gets subsumed inside the other. Of course, at the moment, it's just a theoretical observation, not something that concretely you can use. So finding a point, really computing this Euler-Lagrange equation that allows you to find the global point, is the actual goal. Yeah, thank you very much.
So, can you say any more about how you think this sort of minus one shifted structure can help you understand something about the?
As I said, if you can find a function whose critical set is really this intersection, right, and we can pull it back to the points here, then we can find points. But of course, I can't really find that function.
So on this last thing, I'm sure you said it, but I didn't pick it up. This is function. Is a function on what space?
Well, so in essence, it should be a function on, I guess, the way it works. So I'm very bad with these things. So Kevin will correct me if I'm wrong. So when you have a Lagrangian intersection, in principle, the way you can realize it is a function on one of the spaces. So in essence, a Lagrangian intersection is like the cotangent bundle of one of the spaces. Right? So the function should be defined on this space, for example, which is correct, of course. That's the kind of thing that we would like if we want to cut out rational points.
It's a function, and that space is what?
It's a local
differentiable manifold?
It's a p-adic.
What is meant by critical?
It's a p-adic algebraic variety.
It has a topology, but does it have a differentiable structure?
You don't need a differentiable structure because here it's algebraic, actually.
So what does critical point mean?
It's the same thing, df equals zero. You need this algebraic theory of differential forms. Of course.
So it's some quasi-discrete analog?
No, it's not discrete. It's more, it's an algebraic analog.
You pretend you're an undergraduate.
That's right.
Remember the only thing you know about differentiating, which is the, like,
that's
the,
right, yeah.
You know, the derivative of x to the n is.
So are these all rational functions?
A polynomial type function. That's right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. That's right.
I see.
That's right.
Have you ever tried to compare this to what Gontrov was doing, this stuff, where he was trying to show the Hodge-Galois group acts on the fundamental group?
Yeah, well, that's to be honest, I can never understand what Gontrov is doing, but but in principle, yeah, it's strongly related because suppose you want to really understand the geometry of these moduli spaces, right? Then what you need to do is you do need to understand the way the Galois group acts on the fundamental group, right? So one of the advantages of working with the unipotent completion is that you can break down the understanding of this action to various graded pieces, yeah, which makes gives you a lot of abelian information, out of which you can sort of try to bootstrap up to the non-abelian setting. So that's the reason I've been using the unipotent completion. But understanding the full Galois action is very difficult, and of course, Goncharov and other people think about that quite a lot. The Galois action is one thing, the Hodge theory is the other thing. So, which I've been suppressing here, that the Hodge theory, of course, Goncharov and others study the complex Hodge theory a lot. Of course, I'm here interested in the periodic Hodge theory, which is important in computing these local modulus spaces.
Is there some sort of continuum version? Continuum version of this? I don't know what it may be, using a field C or R. Or trivial, or?
Can you do this over the real? That's actually an interesting question. I don't know. I don't think you can do it over the real. So this, because somehow you are using this Galois action, the richness of this Galois action in a very complicated way. Yeah? And the Galois group of the reals is just Z mod 2. And that somehow doesn't seem to contain much information necessary to apply to this kind of problem.
Yeah. Replace the Galois group by the Hodge Galois group?
In some sense, that's right. So that gives you more. Yeah, that's right. So he works on those things a lot. That gives you more structure on these things, but it's still not quite like these local Galois groups.
Yes, absolutely.
So that's the periodic theory seems to be a richer source of analysis and geometry that you can use in number theoretic problems. That's a kind of vague answer to your question.
Any other questions? Why don't we thank the speaker?
Oh, thank you.